This is London calling North America. Next, we present London Letter by John Connell. Stand by for London Letter. This is London calling North America. The British Broadcasting Corporation presents London Letter, in which John Connell, novelist and editorial writer of one of London's daily newspapers, gives his comments on interesting happenings of the week.
This is John Connell from London. Ever since the war, there's been one quite inexplicable mystery about Christmas here in Britain. Each year, there are the most doleful rumours, from the end of November onwards, about how few turkeys there are going to be in the shops and the fantastic number that are being sold on the side. All this each year is very distressing for the nervous citizen, because, as I'm sure you know, turkey is our traditional Christmas dish, just as it's your traditional Thanksgiving Day dish. By about a fortnight before Christmas, there's a great deal of apprehension in the air and a widespread belief that nobody is going to get a turkey. And then comes Christmas itself. And somehow, I don't pretend to know how, everybody has a turkey. We've got a turkey. All our neighbours have got turkeys. The friends we're dining with on Christmas night have got a turkey. The friends we're spending Boxing Day with have got a turkey. My own belief is that every single family in Britain that wants a turkey has had one this Christmas. I'm not going to attempt to explain this very puzzling social phenomenon. One thoroughly destructive theory which I have heard is that the whole rumour is started each year by Mr. Strachey, the Food Minister. Another is that it's all just crowd psychology. And I've heard the story of the shortage of turkeys likened to the story of the thousands of Russian soldiers who were supposed to have passed through Britain in 1914 on their way to fight on the Western Front. Nobody had actually seen them, but everybody had an aunt who knew somebody who had. Everybody had highly circumstantial, but second-hand, evidence about the sealed trains in which they'd travelled. A very popular story was that of the porter who'd had a glimpse of them at Crewe railway station, and he could tell they were Russians because they had snow on their boots. And another, which got a very good hearing, was that the whole affair was established beyond doubt, because all the slot machines in the station at Birmingham refused to work, being choked up with rubles. That really is the measure of the rumour of shortages of turkeys in Britain every Christmas nowadays. Do you know, I once spent a Christmas chasing a once similar kind of rumour. It was 15 years ago, and I was a very young, very raw reporter on my paper. And all the newspapers in Britain that December were filled with stories of the Loch Ness Monster, a mysterious beast like a fabulous sea serpent, which was reported to have been seen from time to time frisking about in the waters of Loch Ness in the north of Scotland. On Christmas Eve, the news editor sent for me. He was a formidable-looking fellow with a soft voice and a steely, suspicious manner. "Young Connell," he said, "you're Scotch." I agreed. "You're a bachelor?" I agreed. "At a loose end for Christmas, I dare say." I began to demur, but he interrupted me very firmly. "Just the job, my boy, just the job. Get yourself £20 from the cashier and a return railway ticket, third class, mind, and go to Inverness." "Please, why?" I asked rather forlornly. "There's a very good story there. Needs a bright lad to dig it out. The Loch Ness Monster. Might make your name if you handled it right." So off I trundled by the night train to spend Christmas 500 miles away from my snug little apartment and my warm little bed. And of course, it didn't make my name. I spent 3 nights in a wee fishing inn at a place called Drumnadrochit on the north side of the loch, whose proprietor was mighty surprised and mighty pleased to have so many rooms occupied at the slack season of the year. And the days were as mild and as balmy as June, and the companionship in the evenings was very elegant and very instructive for a young man at the outset of his career. There were three photographers from Glasgow. There was a young American from one of the big agencies. And there was a hard-bitten elderly feature writer from my paper's most immediate rival. There was, too, one of my best friends from the university, whose news editor had sent him forth on the same kind of thin excuse as mine had sent me. We ate porridge and cream and grilled trout and haggis, but never the smallest flicker of that monster's tail did we see. My rival, the elderly feature writer, had, it is true, nobbled the only boat that was for hire. He would share it with nobody. Every morning, very early, he took it across to a little beach on the far shore. We watched him through field glasses while he pottered on this beach, but we had no idea what he was doing. Then he disappeared one afternoon, and his paper next day had large and impressive photographs of the paw prints of an enormous beast on the golden sand of this little beach. The sight of these photographs was most disturbing, and my news editor was soon bullying me across 500 miles of telephone wire. So I, and the photographers, and my friend from the university, and a strange old clergyman who inexplicably insisted on accompanying us, got in the little boat, now free for us to hire, and went across to the beach. Now the weather had been calm for days, and there are no tides in Loch Ness. Yet, by some strange freak of nature, the waters had swept up and wiped away every trace of paw marks from that golden sand. Not, I've always thought, not the least mysterious circumstance surrounding that great mystery, the Loch Ness Monster. There are those who hold that for several days the cast of the hoof of a hippopotamus was on loan from the Inverness Museum, and they even go so far as to argue that the photograph in my rival's paper was obviously of the spoor or hoof mark of a hippopotamus. And live hippopotamuses are rarely seen in the north of Scotland. Be that as it may, we were all very discouraged, and I had no story. Rather sadly, we set out back across the loch. It was a beautiful day, sunlit, calm, and equable. Suddenly, the queer old clergyman, who'd hitherto said nothing at all, suddenly he stood up in the boat and shouted and pressed his fingers to his nose. The gentle breeze stirred his long grey beard. His eyes glittered. His coat flapped about him. The rest of us stared at him in some apprehension. The rowers shipped their oars. The photographers began to fiddle with their cameras. And I must confess, prospects which were confused but entrancing flitted through my imagination. Was it to be death leap by distinguished cleric and young pressman's heroic rescue bid? However, he immediately gave tongue. "The monster's here," he proclaimed exultantly. "She's in the air. I can smell her. Can you no perceive her yourselves?" We could, of course, perceive nothing at all, but this did not deter the reverend gentleman. He flung his arms wide and pointed fixedly, dramatically, at a sheet of calm, unruffled water. "There she goes now," he announced, in a voice that brooked no questions. "There she goes, straight for the head of the loch, now." We all stared in the direction in which he was pointing. But alas, no writhing coils of serpentine body broke the smooth surface of the loch. No strange prehistoric head peered agitatedly about in the winter sunshine. The old man sat down in the boat again, and we explained our difficulty. He didn't appear surprised. "Yours is a generation without faith," he observed somberly. "A generation without faith." He shook his head at us in slow, sad condemnation, and we rode back to Drumnadrochit. The whole episode, or perhaps it was just young Clunnell's handling of it, pleased my news editor as little as it had pleased the eccentric clergyman. It was a long time before I was allowed out on another jaunt as carefree or as funny. That was 15 years ago this December, and yet it's as clear and vivid in my mind as if it had happened the week before last. And I think that has something to do with the season of the year. In just short of 40 years of life, I find that I can remember in clear and factual detail every Christmas since I was 4. The older I get, the more fully do I remember past Christmases. In that, I don't believe I'm unusual. Christmas, of all the seasons of the year, is the one in which the mind remembers and the heart goes home. I wonder if you remember, I wonder if you'll mind my reading to you, a passage of Hilaire Belloc's on just this theme. It's in an essay called A Remaining Christmas. It describes the vicissitudes to which men are subject, and the reassurance and the consolation which they may derive from observing holy and traditional seasons such as Christmas. Man, says Belloc, has a body as well as a soul, and the whole of man, soul and body, is nourished sanely by a multiplicity of observed traditional things. Moreover, there is this great quality in the unchanging practice of the holy seasons, that it makes explicable, tolerable and normal, what is otherwise a shocking and intolerable, and even in the fullest sense, abnormal thing. I mean the mortality of immortal man. Not only death, which shakes and rends all that is human in us, creating a monstrous separation and threatening the soul, an isolation which destroys. Not only death, but that accompaniment of mortality, which is a perpetual series of lesser deaths and is called change, are challenged, chained, and put in their place by unaltered and successive acts of seasonable regard for loss and dereliction and mutability. The threats of despair, remorse, necessary expiation, weariness almost beyond bearing, dull repetition of things apparently fruitless, unnecessary and without meaning, estrangement, the misunderstanding of mind by mind, forgetfulness which is a false alarm, grief and repentance which are true ones but of a sad company. Young men perished in battle before their parents had lost vigor in age. The perils of sickness in the body and even in the mind. Anxiety, honor harassed, all the bitterness of living become part of a large business which may lead to beatitude. For they are all connected in the memory with holy day after holy day, year by year, binding the generations together, and giving corporate substance, permanence and stability, without the symbol of which, at least, the vast increasing burden of life might at last conquer us and be no longer borne. I suppose it's the condition of human life that we wander and seek always to find our way home. Christmas is the symbol of the setting out and the coming back. Each of us has his own Bethlehem in his spirit, and to that we turn. I've had to spend too many Christmases in desolate and distant places. I know now that all the joy of it is summed up in being at home, in the surroundings that I know and love, in the company of those I love. The star that beckons men on to adventure and the lust of knowledge and power, that star brings them at the road's end to a family gathered together and a newborn child. It's an old story and a wise story. And this is John Connell signing off in London.
John Connell was speaking in the series London Letter. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.